Live from Run Your Mouth World Headquarters.
First up, what the lunar eclipse means for your bowel movements. Black hole sun, won't you come? Next, the earthquake caused by Lizzo's return to music. Next up, with an avian flu outbreak, the CDC warns against having sex with chickens. And lastly, with Florida restricting abortion access, we detail the new travel destinations to flush your kid.
It's your daily dose of misinformation pulled from a lightly hemorrhoided asshole. It's today's Run Your Mouth!
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to a brand new episode of the Run Your Mouth podcast. Was that intro a little bit too disturbing today? I had fun putting it together. All right, listen, we got a lot of topics to get into. We've got a jam-packed episode. We've got guests coming on later in the show. First thing I would like to talk about, though, is I had an experience yesterday. I was in New York City. I needed to buy a cable. My phone was dying, right? My phone was dying, and all I needed was one of those cables. And I went into a Target that was in Union Square, and I was like, you know what? That's oddly convenient. I feel like I'll be able to get myself a charging cable in there. And it was an entire brand new, nice new Target where every single thing was locked up. And it's an odd experience being able to walk around a store and look at things that you can't actually purchase because they're behind a case. And yes, did I click every single button in the entire store to try and find an employee? Of course I did. Did I then walk up to employees and say, hi, would you mind opening that thing so I could purchase something for them to, it was like being on hold with a Target in India where every single one of them is like, oh, you're going to have to go find that. You're going to have to go find the department guy. He's going to have to call the key guy. You're going to have to, it was an entire store of things that you couldn't buy. It's very odd when you're walking around. You're like, yeah, but I have the money. I'm not poor. I actually work for a living and I can purchase the thing in there. This is the way socialism works. They've reduced all of us to being poor people that can't afford anything because they build fake stores. They put all the items behind glass cases. They got no one who's going to work in the store that's going to open up the glass cases. And they're all going to be going for bailouts. It's going to be the Target. We locked everything up into a box bailout. How is this business model going to work? I'm sure at the corporate level, they sit around and they go, listen, there's too much stealing, so it's no big deal. We'll just put everything behind a case and we'll make sure that we'll have enough employees. And that's the problem. Employees don't want to work until you can get some robot system. By the way, a robot system's not that bad. It takes your picture and then it opens up the case. And then they know if you walk out of the place without stealing. There you go, Target. robsnewsroom@gmail.com. You can email me. I'll solve every single one of your business problems. You just have to be okay with AI at this point that's going to take a picture of your face, and then they're going to register on the way out. If that matches the face, I just solved your problem. You know how infuriating and weird it is to be inside of a store, go, oh, that's the exact thing that I really need, and then have it be locked up, and you're not, it's like every, you might as well be inside of a closed store. It's a store telling you that it's open, but it's actually closed. It's just, you know what? Louis C.K. used to have this great joke. You guys can go look this up. Early Louis C.K. I think it might have been on Letterman. I might even mess up this joke. But firstly, he had this joke about, do you ever run into someone you don't know twice? Like God's just running out of extras in the story of your life. I'm butchering these old jokes, but these were all great jokes. But then he had one about what he would do if he had all of Bill Gates's money and he would open up the really shitty shit store. And everything in the entire store would cost $2 million that you would just pick up like a can of something in a store the size of a Walmart. I'm totally butchering his joke. You can go watch his version. I'm going off the top of my head. I didn't even realize that his joke literally came to life. But you would pick up a can and it would be $2 million. Be like, who the hell could afford this? And it would just be a big prank because no one can afford a $2 million thing. And you'd be thinking, who the fuck can afford just to have a store here with nothing inside of it that I can purchase? And guess what? I guess the billionaires have figured that out with their big prank where they move so many homeless people into the city. They go, oh, well, we have no choice but to put everything behind lock and keys. And then they got no one that can open up the things. So you keep walking around these cities thinking there's going to be places that you can buy things. You can walk into a store, look at the exact thing that you need to buy, and no one's going to sell it to you. Unbelievable. All right, next topic. Does anyone care about the solar eclipse? Are we supposed to care about the solar eclipse? Are you guys getting into the solar eclipse? Is there going to be like new energy where I'm going to be able to find my lover, or is the universe going to be more blocked at this point in time? Is NASA starting to keep moon time because they expect aliens to come through some portal as the planets line up? Should we actually be interested in the fact that there's all sorts of numbers fours out there? I like hearts. I like hard fours. Maybe I should go play craps during the lunar eclipse. Maybe that's what this is coming down to. It's a signal from God that there's going to be good juju for the numbers fours. And so if you can spend the entire day indoors, not looking at the lunar eclipse, and hopefully other people aren't getting this exact same message, you can go play hard eights, or eight the hard way, I guess is the better way to say that, all day. All day. That's I think I got my plans. Mohegan Sun, here I come. Everybody, if you want to chip into the lunar eclipse hard eight funds, you can hit me up, robsnewsroom@gmail.com. Everyone can pool their money. Let me tell you, I like craps when I can roll. When I can roll, it's a fun game. When other people are rolling, not as much. But seriously, you guys getting into the lunar eclipse? Is this something that we should actually care about? The last time they made a big stink about of eclipse, I pulled a very New York move. Usually, I'm a docile person, but I pulled an aggressive move because I didn't buy those little goggle things. I thought I didn't care. And then all of a sudden, you see all these people who are outside in the park in New York City, and they're looking up, and they're all making a big stink, and you start thinking, hey, am I missing out on seeing something here? And so I bullied someone into giving me their goggles very briefly. I was like, hey, man, can I take a peek? He handed it to me. A boy looked up. I was like, all right, I don't know why this is so exciting. Is this me just being a curmudgeon that I can't care about anything? Is there something actually exciting about this? Is there some sort of a lunar energy that I'm supposed to be aware of? Listen, once we have the content producer, we'll start getting some people on the show who can fill us in on these details. We'll get some of these freaks of natures out there with their crystals, obsessed with how they're in Aries and how you can only get along with this and how when the stars are aligned, it's supposed to lead to this thing. All right, next up. Porch store is actually coming together. Shout out to the fan that hooked me up with a bunch of Adderalls because I'm really bad at making decisions. I spent 2 hours deciding yesterday. Are you guys good at making decisions? How do you make quick decisions? I feel like everything's got too many moving pieces and you want to make the best decision. You don't want to make a shitty decision, you know? And so even simple things like I used to panic when I had to go grocery shopping. I would tire out looking at an apple because if I'm going to buy an apple, I want to get a good apple. And then you inspect them all. You're trying to evaluate this. And then you realize it's an apple. Let me just move on with my life. But then there's other things I can't do that for. Like I have a couple days left on my ski pass from the beginning of the season. And I've been wanting to get up and use the last 3 days. Got very lucky with Park City. And that was a blast. But I've been wanting to get up to Stowe because that's on my pass. I've never skied at Stowe. Stowe's always been too expensive, too outside of my budget skiing. And then you're like, can I beat the storm? Do I go up after the storm? What hotel rooms are available? Can I even afford that hotel room? This one's only got one bed. That one's got two beds. And then it's like 3 days later and you just want to go to sleep. You're like, I spent three. And you guys should see porch tour decisions. Are you trying to line up? Does this city fit with that city? What do the flights cost if I go at this time, at that time? A lot of variables going on. But luckily, someone gave me some Adderall, so I've been locked in. I've actually been scheduling the dates, and we've got all sorts of porch tours. It's coming to fruition. And everything, by the way, I'm telling you, by the time September, October comes around, I'm going to have like a brand new 30 minutes or so. Maybe not, but you know, just feel the moon energy and you got to throw these things out there. You got to put your prayers in before you take all your money down to the casino and start rolling for eights the hard way. But anyways, guys, still some openings left. Everything that we did last year, I'm pushing off to like September, October. We'll rename it the fall something. And it's nice weather out west. So we can be doing September, October. I just want to make sure I got new material when I re-hit your backyards. But we're lining up some new cities, some that we didn't do last year. I think I just confirmed Pittsburgh. I think that's going to happen. Bunch of dates coming. Well, we'll get them all up. I don't have to yell about things that don't exist yet. So robsnewsroom@gmail.com. If you got a porch, hit me up. And all right, one last random topic, and then we'll get into the news. And I do have Kyle. There's no way I'm going to pronounce this last name right, even though I've spoken to the kid a thousand times. I think it's Osnone. Whatever, dude, he's brilliant. He knows all of his shit. And I got into an argument with a friend on a whole bunch of Israel stuff. And I was like, you know what? I got to fact check some of this bullshit I'm yelling. I even woke up his kids. It got feisty. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go do my homework. I'm going to fact check and come back here. So I hit up Kyle because that's easier than reading, right? Meeting random people that know more information than you and then getting them to come on your podcast, that is way easier than reading. I recommend for everyone who listens to the show, just get yourself a podcast so that occasionally you can reach out to people and pick their brain. And people aren't just going to take your call. That's not going to happen in life. You know, if you just want to be like, hey, you're an expert on this and you mind having a phone call with me, maybe try that. Maybe try cold calling experts. Just call up a doctor. Am I a patient here? No. But can I talk to the doctor? I just have some random questions. I bet you could do that with college professors, because college professors spend their entire day in classes with people that have no interest in what they have to say. Especially if you get someone who's like, I went to Queens College, right? And if you go to like those colleges with people that just want the degree and have no, it's not Harvard. No one's going there because they're really interested in any topic matter. They're all the people that couldn't get into better schools and were told that they're supposed to go to college. So they show up to this college. And now maybe in the more advanced classes or later on, when you're past all the preliminary classes, you might get some interested students. But when you get those classes that you have to take in the first 2 years, it's people not showing up. It's like the worst version of high school. Everyone's sitting on their laptops playing games. I even watched a teacher just break down once in front of the class and go, none of you care about this at all. Why are you in this class? Oh, right. It's required. And that's why I get to pretend that I have this prestigious college job. How so? Like, at least, you know, I get to work on my jokes and then never have to see that audience again. What's it like teaching a class to nobody that cares? You know that they don't care, but you're collecting your paycheck and they're all forced to take your class. You just show up and give the exact same lecture over and over to absolutely nobody that's interested. I bet those people you could cold call for information. They would be like, wait a second, do you actually care about what I have to say? Wait, you're curious about the ancient Roman ruins of I don't even know. All right, that's it for today's intro. Shout out Sheath. I'm wearing the Sheaths. Use promo code RYM, get 20% off the greatest underwear that's ever graced the balls of man. I swear by my Sheath underwears, and I'm trying to get back on my bike and actually ride it a little bit more. And you can't be doing that without the Sheaths on. All right, let's change my setting here, and let's try and take a couple comments. What do we got going on in the chat? It seems lively. We've got 185 people hanging out. What do we got? What was everyone saying in the thing? Matt Freedom Memes. Last eclipse, I traveled a few hours to get the right in the center. It was cool as fuck. What was cool about it? Like, I just, you know, maybe from New York City, just everything's kind of, the energy's just not right and you can't appreciate the stars. And so I was in the wrong setting to get the moon vibrations. Wade Mosher, the intro didn't have sound for me. Oh, that kind of sucks. It was a good intro. It was actually the best intro I think I've done yet. It was rather disturbing, if I'm going to be honest. Was no one able to hear the intro? Maybe right now I'll try and replay it. So that means like my sound settings are probably off again. Stupid fucking producer. Jeff Gordon's mom. I see the notification bell and got nothing. You're getting shadow banned hardcore. I'm aware of it. What are you going to do? Complain? Hands Liberty. The lunar eclipse is a hoax. It's the elites disguising that they control the moon. Yeah, they could line it up every day. This could be a daily occurrence where we go outside. And when they ring the stock market, you could just see the moon. Or maybe every once in a while, is it that they remove the moon? Hans, you're going to have to come back with some more information on that one. Rob is looking fit. Those apples are doing you right. It's just the Sheath shirt. You got to get the Sheath shirts. They hold everything in place. They make dicks look bigger and your tits look smaller. Red Muskrat. And someone send that clip to Bobby. Bobby the Bank. Let him know that I keep plugging it. We'll flex a little bit. Go send that to Bobby the Bank. Sheath makes your dick look bigger and your tits look smaller. Sheathunderwear.com, promo code RYM. Someone go send that. Bobby the Bank. Take the clip, send it to him, and that way he'll keep supporting the Run Your Mouth Enterprise of America. All right, that's it for that. Why don't we take a second and try and replay the intro? Because I like this intro, and I don't want to have to re-edit the show just to showcase the intro. So let's line it up. Let's change our sound settings. Make sure everything's in the right place. No, it's supposed to be headphones, Rode. That should be right, everybody. It's playing through there. We got the settings on the computer to match. I checked that earlier. I don't have to. All right. Here, everyone can see the whole process here. We can X out of this. You guys can see. Got the slideshow thing. We got this set for headphones, Rode. Right. And we went into the settings and we did the people who listen to this not live are going to be so mad that I did not edit out this moment. But you guys don't understand how annoying post-production is. All right. Let's try this again. You guys tell me if you can now hear this. Let's go back to full screen. It's a whole process here, people. Let's move this over here. As long as you talk out loud while you're doing it, people don't mind. That's what I've heard. All right. And now Let's retry the intro. If not, I'm going to have to do the post-production to put it. No sound. Unbelievable. All right, wait, let's just try it once more. We'll try one different setting and then we'll move on because I didn't have too many videos playing in this episode. So if it doesn't work, it's not that big of a deal. So let's try it once more. All right, no sound. Moving on. Whatever. I'll put it up separately. You guys can go watch the intro, and now you can laugh about the fact that I have to do 2 hours of post-production, which is the whole reason I like going live anyways. All right, we don't have to complain because, you know what? As much as I mess up in the studio, government's messing up worse, and how's that for a transition to Oregon is recriminalizing. Oh, that, you know what? That's a good joke. Benny the Jet coming through with a good joke that Lizzo ate the sound. I appreciate that. Okay. Oregon is recriminalizing drugs. Here's what Portland learned. And I just want to say off the bat, the fact that Portland blew this for the rest of us is not proof that legalized drugs won't work. The fact that you went to the worst city in America that was already having a tremendous amount of problems, and then you tried to legalize drugs, and it wasn't even like the fun drugs. It wasn't like people are going to be outside taking mushrooms and learning like, oh, maybe I should do something with my life. Or it's not like people were doing cocaine and then being like, you know what? I could do better than this tent. Let me go talk to that other homeless guy. Maybe we can get a business going. And then they start talking about business plans and getting excited about doing something. They weren't taking those kind of drugs, or they weren't even like smoking weed and then helping the economy by somebody purchasing all the donuts that were out there. No, they're doing fentanyl. That's not a drug that's going to help people get their shit together. And don't tell me that we can't be having clean cocaine to help us be making better run your mouths because the people out in Portland blew it for all of us doing fentanyl in their tents. You can't take the people that already don't have their shit together, go, oh, well, we tried free, or I mean, sorry, we tried clean drugs with these people and it didn't work. So no one's going to be able to have access to clean. By the way, did they even have like clean drug stores on the corner, or were they just buying fentanyl from the other tents? So I'm just saying, let's not take this as the example of, oh, look, legalizing drugs don't work because you went to the worst city in America that was already falling apart and then you tried it and it didn't work. Now, it seems to me like recriminalizing drugs with homeless drug addicts is going to be tough to prosecute because when you bring them to court and they're like, yeah, I didn't know you changed the law. I was outside doing drugs. I've been outside doing drugs. What, you told me? What, when I was passed out on Thursday? You can't, and ignorance of the law is no excuse for not holding the law. Yeah, well, good luck retraining these people that you told that they could be outside doing fentanyl, that they can no longer just be outside doing fentanyl. Good luck with that one. Good luck with that transition. You start, what are you going to go tent to tent? You go tent to tent, you give it a knock. And you try and unzip the guy's tent and give him a notice. Hey, listen, starting next week, you can't be out here doing those drugs anymore. And now this is fun. Apparently, they're going to have a hard time reinstituting this because they don't have enough public defenders available to defend these people. And by the way, I feel like defending these people probably isn't that difficult. It's kind of like, you know, when you were a kid and you got yourself a little bit of a fish tank, and then there's like those little bottom feeder things that eat all the other fish poop. Maybe these people are actually helping the drug usage in those societies by doing all the fentanyl for people. Like, instead of there being fentanyl in all of our drugs, the people that are so accustomed to drug usage that they can actually handle the fentanyl, they're outside doing the fentanyl, which then cleans the drug for the rest of us. So, Your Honor, these people are actually good for the rest of Portland and our economy, and that they act like a fentanyl filter for trying to get all that stuff out of the drugs that the rest of us are doing. Or it's even better where they're like, you know, you're defending your client and then They're like, does the client have a statement? Your Honor, I think he just shat himself. And no, I don't think he's going to get the message. I mean, if you'd rather him sit in jail than on the street, and you can do that, but I don't think he's going to learn on this one. I had more on this. Hold on. Man, everything's falling apart today. What do we got? This is more from this article. So this is from Mr. Wheeler, who I guess is the Portland mayor. Over the past year, Mr. Wheeler has set out to restore order. He has battled in court to ban daytime camping. Daytime camping's not a thing. That's not a real thing. There's never been a person who thought, oh, you know what? I'm just going to go camping in the middle of Portland. That you're just homeless people. Can you just say we didn't realize how many homeless? There's never been a daytime urban camper person ever. Nobody's ever bought camping gear and thought, you know what? Instead of going to the woods and looking at nature, I'm going to pitch this tent on a street corner in Portland. I've always wanted to just hang out in the middle of Austin on a busy street where I have to listen to everyone outside of my tent and be nervous that they might kick or do something to my tent. That's always been adventurous to me. I've always wanted to wake up at 4 a.m, come outside of my tent, need to use the bathroom, and be surrounded by strangers who are annoyed that I'm there. That's what I like doing when I don't know what you guys do when you're on a camping adventure. I don't know if maybe you guys like going to a lake, a river, a place that you can fish, getting away from the rest of society. That used to be what camping was. You wanted to go to some campsite and do drugs, and then you found out that they have that the one park ranger there. All right, and then here was more just showcasing the absolute stupidity of Portland. All right, where do you think things most went wrong with the measure? This is from the mayor of Portland reflecting on why legal drugs or decriminalizing hard drugs in Portland didn't work. There's no question that the state botched the implementation. And as I say, the timing couldn't have been worse. In terms of botched implementation, to decriminalize the use of drugs before you actually had the treatment services in place was obviously a huge mistake. How government is this? Well, you see, when we passed the measure, you see, we didn't really plan. And so, you know, the thing didn't work because we didn't really plan. And so it fell apart on us because the other infrastructure we would have needed for this to work wasn't there. So we just had more of the drug usage. Doesn't this sound a little bit like the transition to the electric vehicles? They're just giving us the electric vehicles without the infrastructure in place to actually power all of them, without of our electricity bills going up, or the other changes that they're trying to do in these cities to get people off the gas heat and all these other things without the infrastructure of enough electricity. You guys, you remember we played that video where Thomas Massie was asking Pete Buttigieg, and Pete Buttigieg was like, well, we're just imagining that shit's, yeah, because it's called not planning. If you don't actually have the infrastructure in place for the changes you're trying to implement, it's not going to work. But here you get to use your fancy terms of it was botched implementation because you didn't plan. All right, let's continue. With the benefit of hindsight, the way that should have been structured is that it would create the mechanism for funding. The state would build up its behavioral health services, and when it reached a certain threshold, they would decriminalize. It should have gone the other way around. All right, next up, this is actually on the same topic because I thought that this so showcased absolute liberal stupidity. At the same time, in relatively recent polling, I think 81% said they feel unsafe going downtown in Portland at night. Are they wrong to feel that way? Here's the mayor's response. I would never tell anybody they're wrong to feel unsafe. If you feel unsafe, you feel unsafe. Do you understand how broken of a philosophy that is? That's a philosophy of embracing mental illness. If I told you I felt unsafe in my house, and so every single day I triple lock the door, I get under the bed, I hold a knife, I don't sleep at night, and I yell sporadically, get away from me, ghosts, and there were no ghosts and there was no danger in my area, wouldn't you tell me, hey, there's no reason to feel unsafe? This is mental illness. Is that not exactly the problem? You know how many times I have to fight my own feelings because they're stupid feelings? You know, like it's called anxiety, where you feel like things are wrong and you have to talk yourself out of like, hey, you're just, every time before a comedy set, I don't know how to do this. I can't do this. Why am I doing this to myself? No one likes my jokes. And then I got to go, nah, you do this all the time. You're pretty good at it. You've been doing it a while. Your jokes work. And then I go do it. And then I'm like, oh yeah, that was great. How many, and I mean, that's just one example. You know how many crazy thoughts I have floating through my head all the time? And this is the philosophy of the left is, no, if you have a feeling, it's why would I invalidate your stupid feeling? If all objective data is that you can leave your house and enjoy sunlight, but you're afraid of the sun, I shouldn't tell you not to be afraid of the sun. If you think that you're a woman and that your life would be better spent as a lady, even though you're clearly, who am I to invalidate your feelings? I mean, whatever feeling you're having right now, I remember once I saw one of my instances of seeing a shrink in life, and he was like, just follow your instincts. And I was like, that's the worst advice. If I follow my instincts, I would spend my entire day eating cookies and jerking off. Those are my instincts. Life's about overcoming your instincts. If I follow my instincts, it would be every single time I went to do something, I'd be like, nah, you know what? This is too much. Yeah, that's mostly my brain is just telling me, do you really want to go see that concert that you already bought the tickets for, to your favorite band that's just one town over that you're really, it seems like too much. Just stay home. That's my instincts. All right, moving on. What do we got next? Before we take our next topic, shout out, hanging out in the chat, YoKratom.com, home of the $60 kilo. If you guys are a fan of Kratom products, you will not find better pricing anywhere than YoKratom.com, home of the $60 kilo. Personally, been a big fan recently of the Red Mane Daz. You can go and you can buy yourself the giant bags of powder, and you can be mixing up your tea all day. I like a nice pip, a simple pill. The Red Mane Daz, let me tell you, take that every once in a while, you can have some real lucid dreams. YoKratom.com, home of the $60 kilo. But I can't actually, my personal experience is having some crazy fucking dreams. All right, next up is, if you guys were afraid of pollution and global warming, good news, we're going to pollute the skies to make it better. If you guys were concerned that the world was going to go to shit, and that because of carbon, which, has always existed in the environment and, creates trees, and there seems to be this natural balance between carbon dioxide and the plant life on the planet, where we put more carbon dioxide in and then the trees grow bigger and then you end up with more oxygen, seems like a pretty great system. But if you guys were afraid of that carbon thing, don't worry. Scientists are figuring out other bullshit chemicals that they can put into the sky to block out the sun, because we got to counterbalance what's going on with the carbon. This is from the New York Times. Infusing clouds with sulfur dioxide. I'm sure that's better for the environment. Isn't sulfur dioxide the thing that smells like farts? Isn't that the eggy fart smell you get when you go to like really poor areas, or like you go out to Staten Island, they got all those old dumps down there. Isn't that what sulfur dioxide is? Infusing clouds with sulfur dioxide to block the sun, vacuuming carbon dioxide out of thin air, adding iron to the ocean to draw greenhouse gases down to the seafloor. As recently as a few years ago, technologies designed to change the Earth's atmosphere, what is broadly known as geoengineering, were considered too impractical, too expensive, and too outlandish to be taken seriously. But as I write in a new article, some of these technologies are being deployed. One is already in place. The effects of climate change are becoming worse, and nations aren't meeting their collective goals of slashing greenhouse gas emissions. The stakes are very real. Last year was the hottest in modern history. Oceans around the world are shockingly warm. Floods, fires, and droughts are growing more intense. We have no choice but to take matters into our own hands. And I like this one. Something about underground bubbles. They're going to start shoving carbon monoxide into how soon till the Earth just starts farting on us. It might not be all that bad. You're on a date, and then you could be like, yeah, the Earth just did that. That had nothing to do with me. By the way, nice perk to being in Chicago in the Windy City. If you're outdoors, you can let them rip. You can be with the lady of your dreams, walking around, holding hands, and just woof, right into the wind. Doesn't matter. All right. What do we got? What do we got coming on? This was one more thing about the geoengineering. Despite these concerns, the market for these ventures is set to boom from less than $10 billion today to as much as $135 billion by 2040, according to Boston Consulting Group. Occidental is planning to build 100 plants in the coming years, funded in part by $1.2 billion in funding for the technology from the Biden administration. And that's why, don't sleep on higher carbon reducing trees. I've been saying this more than once. I don't know, maybe one of you guys work in the crypto space, you know how to get financial scams off the ground. You can make some sort of a crypto meme coin, and let's go to this moon behind me. Higher reducing trees to the moon. Can someone create the coin? Higher reducing trees. You get some artist to make some shitty tree and it's going to be funding our project for the higher carbon reducing trees. Look at the funding they're putting into this bullshit that will probably never be enacted. And if it does, probably will never do anything for the environment. Speaking of cryptocurrency scams, cryptocurrency that Sam Bankman-Fried plugged to jail guards is ridden with racist meme coins and Nazi imagery. All right. Firstly, they happen to just be talking about Soldana. This is, I mean, coming from the New York Post, this is usually a tool of the left to try and affiliate anything in any capacity with ultra-right, right-wing, Nazi, blah, blah, blah. How ballsy is it, though, of Sam Bankman-Fried to be in prison pitching crypto coins? Because you got to think about this. If you actually have the in on a good crypto coin and you tell some prison guards, hey, go buy this thing, and they become like fantastically wealthy, you're going to be safe in prison. Okay, they're going to get your back, right? You get a bunch of guards out there and you're like, listen, just trust me on this. Take $1,000 and go buy this thing. You just bought yourself safety. If that thing goes up 10%, I mean, 100-fold, and now all of a sudden that guy's got $100,000, $1 million, whatever. If you can actually give the guy, like if you got the scoop on a cryptocurrency that's like Bitcoin when it was at like 5 cents, and then it shoots up like this, and you just made the prison guard very wealthy, actually might not help because the guy would just leave and retire. And then just, you know, you'd be on your own with the other prison guards. You're like, why the fuck didn't you give me that tip? I was here. You couldn't fucking tell me to go buy that thing also. But that's a ballsy move, being in prison. And you must be, he must feel really good or have the inside scoop on what's going on in Soldana. Because if you're giving bad tips to the prison guards, oh boy. All right, let's get into some of the turmoil going on in the world. I like this one. You got Francis Macron tries to spur tougher stance on Putin, which that's easy to do. It's easy when you're France to be like, oh, I oughta. And just for America and everyone be like, shut the fuck up. You're France. It's like Canada. It's like Canada being like, oh, we're really going to get involved in this one. We really got to. Yeah, because you're in the background. You're not making any decisions. You're stuck with it. Once America and Germany do something, France, you're in the back of the line of like, yeah, I guess I'll play ball with whatever you people are doing. Really easy to pretend like you're the tough guy. Why do you even want to pretend like you're the tough guy? Freeload on the United States and Germany because you're stuck with whatever they're doing anyways. You might as well stand in the background and be like, I would love to get along with Putin. Oh, I keep calling up Putin and telling him how much France would love to get along with him. Why do you want to be in the background of those other two guys pretending like you're tougher than you are? Israel faces massive diplomatic backlash over airstrike that killed American 6 other aid workers. Netanyahu's like, dude, we're bombing civilians here all the time. How are we supposed to know? We're bombing all over the place. We were supposed to know that those were the aid workers bringing in food. I mean, how are we supposed to know? You know how many people were bombing in Gaza? If anything, you guys are getting in the way of us trying to get to Hamas by being there. We're trying to bomb the whole area, and you guys are sending in food and making it that we can't bomb in certain places. How's that supposed to work? And here's the picture. And I guess it was so out in the middle of the road, they couldn't be like, yeah, but there were tunnels underneath. The main infrastructure was right underneath this thing. I heard that donkey over there was working for Hamas. We couldn't not strike this thing. And anyway, you guys are, if you're giving out food, it's going to be to future terrorists. And so we can't be having you guys. I mean, we stand for the civilians of Gaza. We're trying to help them out as much as anybody else. But if you're in there feeding them, that's going to be someone that we have to fight in the future. So obviously this incident was particularly tragic, is the World Central Kitchen is, I think, now pulling out of the area. Hold on, I need a little. Is this yesterday's seltzer? What do you guys think? Is this today's or yesterday's? That was today's. I can't tell you how often I pick up one of these and it's the wrong day seltzer. Let me tell you, there's nothing worse than when it's the wrong day seltzer and you put a nicotine pouch inside of it. You take a nice sip of that. Woo! Talk about going to the moon. I love nicotine pouches. I love seltzer. Those two things should not mix. And certainly shouldn't mix for an entire evening. And certainly if you're live on air and you're really thirsty, you don't want to take a big swig of something. Find out not only was that yesterday's seltzer, but you put your used nicotine pouches in them. All right. So not a great look for Israel because kind of showcases, hey, how indiscriminately are you bombing inside of these areas that you managed to hit these people? Or are you specifically targeting aid agencies that are coming in because you guys are actually trying to create problems in the area targeting civilians so that they have to suffer as well and will not have access to food. These are the kind of questions that you have to ask if the aid people that came in, and at least thus far, they haven't been able to pull that UN move of, well, the UN, the exact people that were supposedly were actually giving cover to the terrorists. They've been working with the terrorists. One of the main terrorist centers was actually underneath the UN the entire time. So this was from the New York Times. Back-to-back Israeli strikes show tragic gaps in choosing targets. And just when you thought absolutely nobody would be able to defend Israel on this one, with even Netanyahu being like, yeah, we did that and shouldn't have done that. That wasn't great. You've got one Jew lawyer who's like, I'll Jew this one. Everyone, he stood up at the conference and he was like, all right, listen, I got this. I got this. I know this one looks really bad, but everyone sit down. I can handle this one. And so here you go. It was not a question of accuracy because it was highly accurate. So there you go. Israel doesn't just bomb. This thing was accurate. They intended to hit something and they hit it, said Yagil Levy, a professor and expert on the Israel Defense Forces at the Open University of Israel. It was not a question of negligence because the action was taken after close consideration of the circumstances. Okay, so it was both highly accurate and it wasn't negligence. So Israel meant to hit these people and they hit exactly who they wanted. And it just happened to be volunteers who were delivering food. But we're only at the beginning of this guy's arguments. Let's not jump to conclusions here. In Gaza, he continued, the IDF is committed to killing as many Hamas fighters as possible. In many cases, targeting Hamas combatants is at odds with the principle of respecting the immunity of civilians. That sounds like an argument for killing civilians. So if you got to get Hamas, and sometimes you'd have to slow down your role of how aggressively you're killing Hamas in order to not kill civilians. But in this case, since you're going full aggressive on killing Hamas, he's saying it's okay to kill civilians. Doesn't matter who they are, even if they're not from the area and just they're trying to deliver some aid. All right, let's continue. Professor Levy said aid convoys in Hamas-controlled Gaza were often guided by armed locals with ties to militant groups to prevent. Oh, that's interesting. So they're armed locals who are helping these people. And this guy's not even claiming that those guys are Hamas or militants, but just that they have affiliations to them. So you can be two-step removed from Hamas. They're helping the aid agencies, but that's still, well, let's continue. I don't want to overly deconstruct this. Professor Levy said aid convoys in Hamas-controlled Gaza were often guarded by armed locals with ties to militants to prevent their supplies from being damaged or stolen. For the Israeli military, which uses drones to monitor the convoys, that raises the prospect that some of the passengers constitute legitimate combat targets. Okay, so the aid people were being escorted by potentially people who might be affiliated to Hamas, so therefore you're actually just allowed to attack them because they might be legitimate combat targets. And since we're trying to kill everyone in Hamas, you know, if we got to kill some civilians in the mix, that's the way it's going to go. All right, there you go. That's the argument from Israel on this one. Sounds not working. We're not going to be able to play this video, but it was somebody grilling Kirby about the fact that it took three strikes in order to take these people out, which would seem to imply that it was intentional and play into questions that people are asking about whether or not Israel is purposely trying to create starvation issues in Gaza. This is another article from the New York Times. Israel bombed an Iranian embassy complex. Is that allowed? I enjoyed this one because you're talking about war here, and we're talking about the prospect of Israel going to war with Iran. And as I'm reading this article, they're basically describing war like freeze tag, where it's like, listen, you can't strike the guy while he's at base. If he's in an embassy, that's base. We all decided that base is safe. You can't be attacking the guy while he's at his base. Sure, he could be your mortal enemy and he could be the leader of the people and a better person to strike than the random civilians within a territory. But if he's in base, we all agreed, no base. And now that you struck the guy while he's at base, that means that we're it. And so we got to figure out how to attack you guys back. You understand? Warfare is just a big old game of freeze tag. The leaders get to stay at base and you're not allowed to strike the base because that's the rules of the game. But then if you strike them, then they're it. And, you know, they got to get you back so that you're it. And then it goes back and forth with escalating conflict, while in truth, no one actually really wants a war. And then this was from The Week magazine. I found this was shocking. We're now jumping from Israel to the situation in Gaza. Why is Ukraine backing far-right militias in Russia? All of a sudden, wait, they're acknowledging the fact that we've been working with Nazis this entire time. And I don't know why Nazis are considered far right. I mean, if you're an extreme American conservative, isn't right and left kind of like more American? And we're talking about extreme conservatives. When do you become such an extreme conservative that you're actually a Nazi? When is like, where is that? Like if the right was a road and you were driving down a road and people had increasingly more conservative views as you continue to go further to the right. So as you drive down this conservative highway and it starts off and it's some people, they just want the government to spend less money. And then you keep driving down the road and suddenly you run into some Christians and they're really against abortion. You drive further down the road and you get these people who are really against abortion and also really pro-Israel. And then you continue driving down the road and somehow you then end up at the Nazis. And somehow in this transition of people who go further to the right, it somehow jumps from Christian conservatives who would actually be for the government, you know, taking the violence out of the video games, making sure that the rap videos didn't have all those booty shakings, making sure that Israel had all of its funding and that no one can get an abortion. But somehow, if you continue down that the road to the right, it somehow goes from that to Nazis. I don't really know where that jump is. Feels like maybe you ended up like you fell off the cliff for the right and now you're in some new category. But for some reason, extreme far right is considered Nazis. All right. So anyways, they're now finally addressing the fact that, as we've been talking about, that we got to restore democracy and we have to work together with the Nazis to now go fight the Russians in the name of democracy. And that even though they're not doing they're not doing elections out there, this is us standing up against Putin's aggression. And by the way, the whole time it was Putin going, hey, I'm just trying to denazify, which was a pretty good talking point. I don't think that's really what he's going for. But in terms of good talking points, saying that, hey, I'm just in this to try and denazify the territory, that was a pretty good talking point. And now you've got our media companies are finally actually admitting to the fact that there are, in fact, Nazis out in the Ukraine, and that in our funding military efforts, we're in part working with the Nazis. Why don't we actually give this a read? Let's go full screen here. The role of Russian militias fighting for Ukraine is back in the spotlight after they launched attacks against the Russian region of Belgorod. Kiev sees the groups as allies against Russian President Vladimir Putin, but the role of the fighters who are based in Ukraine and made up of pro-Kiev Russian volunteers who oppose the Russian president has proven controversial. What did the commentators say? We are the bad guys, but we fight those who are really bad. There you go. All of politics, by the way, is going the way of Donald Trump, where they've just realized if you can keep this to like what a three-year-old could understand, then listen, we're bad, but they're even worse. So we're going to work with our bad guys to fight off their even badder guys. Everyone can understand this. All right, let's continue. To fight those who are really bad, Denis Kopostin, who leads the Russian Volunteer Corps, the largest of the three militias, said to Politico, the alliance is a pet project of, I can't read these names, the head of Ukraine's military intelligence agency, HER, who says the good warriors on Kiev's side is fine because the enemy is their friend. All right. Anyways, it's interesting to me that for some reason the media is actually acknowledging the fact that we've been funding Nazis this entire time. All right. Before we do our next article, let's take a couple comments. And then my guess is Kyle's going to hop on in a couple minutes. Let's see what's going on in the comments sections. What do we got? Joey has sent him an email. I don't know what that was in reference to. Hans Liberty, it is a dangerous game. Tommy J, multiple indiscriminate surgical strikes. Yeah, it doesn't seem to add up. Joey, have you started responding to porch tour requests? Oh, there you go. Robsnewsroom@gmail.com. I have, in fact, and we're starting to line up dates. Pretty soon we'll have a full calendar. Email me, robsnewsroom@gmail.com. Some quack, ashtray, correct. I don't know what the hell that means. Bill Tude, it's a circle. And show Sogino. Damn, I got to watch the replay. Just got here. Yeah, go watch the replay. And also, I'm going to put up the intro separately. The intro might be the most disturbing one I've done yet, so don't miss it. This was from the Wall Street Journal opinion section. And firstly, the first stat I think everyone here should know is that 63% of all audits target taxpayers under $200,000 a year. I don't know how many of you guys in the audience are making $200,000 plus a year or above 150. But, you know, I don't know. I should get a subscriber bracket for you fine people. Go buy Morio Kratom and Sheets. You guys can afford it. But anyways, for all that talk of audits over $400,000, don't worry, I'm not going after you. 63% of audits are for people making under $200,000 a year. And here was the other thing, though, which sounded interesting, is that working for the IRS, it's a pretty good job. It's paying six figures a year. They'll forgive a whole lot of your student debt. But guess what? A lot of people, they don't want that job. They don't want to be a Fed looking through your money, deciding how much money you owe to the government, which shows cases that anyone that does go work at the IRS as an auditor is a true sociopath. And that also we should continue to apply shame to these people because that seems to work as they're having a tough time recruiting people to do the job. All right, now we've got a guest here. Let's get into some stuff. Hold on. Let me just, let's remove that. Let's pull this up. Mr. Kyle, it's nice to see you. How you doing, buddy?
Doing well, Robbie. Good to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. So I'm going to give this a bit of an introduction because I realize I have to actually fact check some of the nonsense I've been yelling about. I ended up in a pretty grand fight with my friend the other day. It started, we were talking about that Rabbi Shmuley Butt stuff. I'm sure you're familiar with him. I've seen him on the Twitter. And my friend was defending that it was not weird that he has a dildo business with his daughter, right? And I was going nuts. I was like, he can't even defend this. And then that escalated to usually me and him, we don't talk about the Gaza and that kind of stuff. And I will say, I got to put forward, and then I got a lot of questions. So don't worry, I didn't bring you on just so I could talk at you. I got a lot of stuff. I'm giving a bit of an intro. You know, I can come back to this one. You don't have to be here for this part. We can come back to this thing. So what I had him, what I kind of had him concede to is if I could bring evidence to the fact that Israel has indiscriminately bombed in these areas and had a record of supporting Hamas, might you change your opinion of Israel being having some fault or guilt in the situation? And he was like, I kind of walked him into a corner because he was kind of so they're not doing that. And I was like, and then I also realized, and then I'm going to turn it to you, is that I'm mostly working off the New York Times. And if you listen to the show, I hate read the New York Times and criticize everything that they say. So the idea that I've read something in the New York Times about them using dumb bombs or bombing safe corridors after telling people that they were safe or that they were supporting Hamas, I can't stand by that as being factual. Or I wouldn't send someone an article from the New York Times and be like, look, it's in the New York Times, so clearly I'm not lying to you. And that's why I realized you would be worth reaching out to. So why don't we just start here? Because I'm curious to know if there's actually a record of indiscriminate civilian bombings within Gaza or the use of dumb bombs or the bombing of areas that were labeled as safe corridors for travel. I guess that's my starting point. If you have any information on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. So we could get into this a whole bunch. And I would just say, you know, sometimes we do have to look at reports from the New York Times or whatever mainstream outlet, but you know, to see how they're making the claims and what exactly they're using as evidence is important. Sometimes the New York Times will report on something and it's an admission by the Israeli government. You know, they're reporting on something an Israeli minister said. And as long as they're using exact quotes, then, you know, there's nothing wrong with using the New York Times. You just have to be careful when they say, well, an unnamed intelligence official said that we assessed this, that, or something. But they're just quoting somebody, you know, at times it's accurate. But Robbie, you know, what I would dread your friend to and what I would bring up with them is there's this new report in 972 Magazine, which is an Israeli-based outlet and isn't overtly anti-Netanyahu or anything like that. They just do good, solid reporting on Israeli issues. And there's a new report out this week on an AI program that's called Lavender. And this is essentially what, you know, Americans believe the Chinese social credit score is on steroids. It's an AI program that looks at everybody in Gaza and assigns them a score of how likely they are to be Hamas between 1 and 100. And then Israel sets a bar somewhere in there and says, anybody say with a score above 50 or 60 is a member of Hamas. And they put those people on a kill list. And so, you know, there's a lot of questions about how accurate this is. Israel says the accuracy of the people put on the list is 90%. But when you actually get into the report in that magazine, they talk to Israeli officials who say they only spend 20 seconds her name that comes on the list, and all they check is that the person is a male. That's all the only actual criteria to get put on the list that Lavender comes up with to go from there to the kill list. As long as you're a male, they stick you on there. And they say they're only looking at each name for 20 seconds. So that this seems pretty indiscriminate to me.
It's I think I said this once on Part of the Problem, but it's straight up. It's like out of The Godfather when they spare the boy. And they're like, we can't spare the boy. He's going to come back and kill us. And then she convinces him, spare the boy. And then Godfather 2, he goes back to Italy and he kills the old mob guy who I guess had killed his dad, who's sitting in a chair. It almost seems like the Israel argument is we've been so unfair, or we've been so violent in this area, however you want to categorize it. Anyone that's a male is now a potential threat to us because they... I mean, you could even look at it maybe statistically of how many people who turn age 18 in the area. Maybe I don't know. I don't know how many 18-year-olds in Gaza go join Hamas or could be recruited into Hamas. But, you know, there might be statistics to back it. But to me, it doesn't necessarily even let you off the hook if your actions are kind of, you know, I don't even know what I'm saying. I hand it back to you.
No. Yeah. So before the war, the estimates were, I think, between 25 and 30,000 members, the armed portion of Hamas. So, it's important to remember that Hamas is a political party that also has an armed faction, right? And so there are people who work for Hamas who are legitimately doctors or, you know, work for the health ministry in Gaza. And that health ministry was set up by the Palestinian Authority, Fatah, when they were in control of the Gaza Strip back before 2007. And a lot of the officials are the same officials from that period of time. And so there are a lot of people in Gaza who will get labeled as being a part of or affiliated with Hamas who are, you know, merely just government employees. It's like saying that, the local cops are, you know, in the same way complicit with the war in Gaza as President Joe Biden is. It's just not very accurate. But they had 25 to 30,000 fighters at the start of this, and there's 2.3 million people in Gaza. So, you know, the vast, vast majority of people are not armed militants in any stretch of the imagination.
That, even though that this was kind of the part of the argument I actually lost to my friend, was I was saying beyond the civilian casualties, which I don't really think you can defend. The concept of putting a flyer on someone's house and saying, hey, you have to leave this house because we're going to bomb it. We don't know when you can come back here, but there's terrorists in the area. And so if you choose to stay in your home, you're putting yourself at, I was like, that's nonsense. You can't just tell me my house is in a danger area and I have to leave it. That's like you're destroying my home, or you're going to just send me to somewhere with no food, no water, no accommodations. And my friend argued, which I actually thought was somewhat fair, was that if, let's say, imagine that the local police in my area turned out to be a terrorist organization, the FBI was coming into town to get rid of the local police organization, and they told me, we need you to leave your home because we're going to be conducting a operation on your street. And it's not going to be dangerous here. It's going to be dangerous here. He was like, I would for sure leave. And so his argument was kind of the people, by staying, they are somewhat, I guess, showing support or giving cover to Hamas. I might be putting words in his mouth here, but it leads us to a bit of a gray area of when you just give a terrorist designation to people. And so if Hamas does have some, like, you know, legitimate activities that it carries out. For example, you could be the meals guy for Hamas who delivers meals to people. I don't know if they're that charitable or if they're doing that kind of work, but I guess I hand it back to you. Is there some moral ambiguity of just giving the entire organization like a terrorist label, where I guess there's some people in the organization that either aren't terrorists or actually rely on it for, you know, basic human services?
Yeah. So I guess a couple things. The first is that the narrative that he's putting forward is just not true. In fact, in that 972 article that we were talking about before, what the Israeli officials say is that there's a program in there specifically called Where's Daddy? And this is the idea of, you know, when kids are waiting for their parents to come home, they say, Where's Daddy? And what the Israelis are actually doing with names, even of low-level suspected Hamas members, is they wait for the names on the list to return to their houses before blowing it up. And so this is, you know, the exact opposite of what he's saying. And the sources say these are people within the IDF. And I could send you the article to send to your friend if you want, Robbie. But what the sources in the IDF are saying is that if there are 15 or 20 civilians in the home, they are willing to blow it up to get one low-level member. And if they assess that person's a high-level member of Hamas, they're willing to kill 100 or more civilians in the process. And so, I mean, that's the dark part. But even the narrative that your friend's putting forward, because there have been times where Israel will say, you know, this particular area is about to become a war zone and you should leave. And Israel will say anybody who stays behind is a member of Hamas. You have to remember a few things. One, people have been killed while evacuating. But, you know, imagine you're a woman who has like 6 children and you have no car. Your husband's already been killed. How easy is it to evacuate? Or if you have, say, an elderly, you know, a grandparent or something like that, maybe they use oxygen. Again, there's no car. They can't walk miles to get where they need to go. And so it's, you know, just not feasible. It takes months, if not longer, to evacuate. You know, we're not talking about just tens of thousands, but hundreds of thousands of people. This is something that logistically takes a long time. And also you need to have some idea of where they're supposed to go. And people need to have maybe not an incentive to go there, but to know that there's going to be aid waiting for them there. And so often is the case, Israel will send Palestinians to a particular area and they'll find there's no facilities, there's no food. And so, you know, think about it, Robbie, if you have 100,000 people piled up in an area where there's no bathrooms, there's no showers, how fast will disease spread?
You
how
many fest.
Kids will get sick? No, I'm kidding. No, but you know, it's like that, but no Johnny's on the spot. Imagine Pork Fest, but not a single toilet anywhere. This is the situation we're talking about. And so would you leave your house to go to Pork Fest with no toilets? Most people would just stay home.
So just to clarify what you were you saying that Israel will intentionally wait for a target to go back to their house so that they can intent and what's and that's so that they have an excuse to kill the civilians? What do they even point to as the logic for doing so?
Because it confirms the identity and they are where they say they are. And so I guess they figure if you're going into the house, that means you're the person that owns the house.
And they can't wait for you then to walk out and then drop a bomb on you?
So, and a part of this too, Robbie, is you're talking about the smart bombs versus dumb bombs before.
Right.
Another part of this is there is a limited amount of smart bombs, especially when you consider there's a lot of countries that don't want to sell Israel weapons and all the weapons that have gone to Ukraine over the past few years and the shortages already in the tight supply chain. And so when the person walks into their house, if you could just drop a dumb bomb on the house, it saves a smart bomb. Say if Israel thinks there's a Hamas tunnel somewhere or what a command center or whatever they want to call it later on, then they would have that precision guided bomb for that targeting, where if you could just blow up a whole house with a low level guy in it, it doesn't matter so much if you get them or not. Whereas with a high level target, you don't want to miss.
So I guess, just to go back to some of the original stats. So to what extent, I guess, have they been just indiscriminately bombing? Well, I guess what you just said is they actually have math ratios of per target basis, how many civilians are okay with killing. Beyond that, though, I guess you were also saying that we do know that they don't have enough access to smart bombs, that some level of bombing is just absolutely indiscriminate bombing. And then how much, to what extent is it true that there have been incidents of them specifically telling people like this is a safe corridor and then bombing it?
Yeah. Well, the most recent example is with that World Center Kitchen. I believe it's called the charity aid group that was bringing aid into Gaza, where they had a convoy of several cars and Israel bombed the first car. And then they loaded the wounded into the second car and they bombed that car a half mile down the road. And then another half mile down the road, they bombed the third car after they loaded the wounded into that. And so, you know, there is definitely specific targeting of aid groups. There's been pretty well documented cases of Israel targeting aid shipments. There was the flour massacre. I believe that was either at the end of January or beginning of February, where Israel opened fire on a group of Palestinians that were mobbing an aid convoy and, you know, shot hundreds of people. Definitely. There was over 100 people that died. Some of the people that died were killed either by the stampeding mob or Israel fired on the aid trucks as well. So some of the drivers took off and ran some people over. But, you know, they just create this absolute nightmare situation where people were starving to death. You know, as far as the bombing being indiscriminate goes, Robbie, the only issue with that label is a lot of it is intentional. It's just they don't care about killing civilians, right? So to say it's indiscriminate is wrong. In some cases, they're just intentionally targeting civilians like this Where's Daddy program, or there's another AI program Israel is using to generate targets called the Gospel. And that program pits out what they call power targets, things like banks, universities, schools, anything that would be needed to sustain like a society and life. And satellite evidence says, you know, looked at before and after pictures of Gaza, and this was in December, said that 50% of the structures were already destroyed. And so again, indiscriminate really isn't right. It's just, you know, complete and utter destruction.
And I guess in your view, when you see these stories of them targeting the aid or, you know, just recklessly, or intentionally destroying buildings, does this start getting to the level of where in your eyes, they're purposely trying to starve civilians? Like they're purposely, I don't know, how intentional do you think it is in terms of them like really just trying to almost get rid of maybe the entire Gaza civilizations that they never have to contend with them? Like do you think they're just trying to like, you know, skim the herd here so that maybe they can get to a future where they think they can bully them into full compliance? Like, what do you think is the actual mission? They talk about that they just want to get rid of Hamas, and once Hamas is totally gone, they haven't told us what's next. But I guess you look at some of these actions, and I guess the most charitable one is that they just want to so ruthlessly punish them that they're hoping that they turn around and get the message and don't fuck with Israel again. I'm curious, though. You know, I don't pay as much attention to this. I'm curious what you actually think, like the intention, like when they're sitting down and Netanyahu's they're actually, what are we trying to accomplish here? Like, what do you think that conversation is?
Yeah, so I guess first off, Robbie, the reason I think that the actual goal can't be to just eliminate Hamas is things like the Where's Daddy program, where you're willing to kill 15, 20 civilians, including a number of children, for each low level of Hamas that you kill. There's no doubt that Benjamin Netanyahu and the leadership of the Israeli government have heard of Stanley McChrystal. He was the American general in charge of the Afghan war. And there's a famous line of his is that you have insurgent math, where for every two militants you kill, you end up with 20 more militants. Well, you know, when you kill 15 children for each militant you kill, think of the exponential increase of members of the Palestinian community who are going to be willing to take up arms against the Israeli state. I mean, imagine if you're the lone survivor of your entire family, or, you know, even if four members of your family were killed. And you know, I think a lot of Americans would take up arms at that point. And I think that's largely what's going to happen. So the goal really can't be to eliminate Hamas. And the American military and intelligence community hasn't assessed this. The chief of staff, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Charles Q. Brown, said this publicly in October. And even the Israeli Defense Forces have assessed that they cannot eliminate Hamas in this fashion. And so then you have to look at what could the goal possibly be. And it seems like ethnic cleansing is the most likely answer. And that is a pretty serious charge to make. But the Israeli officials have made it very clear that this is their policy. The defense minister, Yoav Gallant, has said that we would not allow any food, water, fuel, or anything into Gaza. And the Israelis have done their best to make that the case. You know, we've talked, and Americans keep hearing, oh, the U.S. government is pressuring Israel to allow more aid into Gaza. Well, over the past 6 months, the number of trucks entering Gaza has plummeted from over 500 a day to under 100 a day. So Israel is doing what they can to limit aid more and more and more, and particularly in the northern half of the Gaza Strip, where it's not just, you know, every human rights organization in the world. And, you know, people like to say, oh, they're anti-Semitic or whatever, but it's not just the United Nations. It's Doctors Without Borders, Human Rights Watch, Oxfam. All these groups are coming out and explicitly saying that Israel is intentionally causing a famine in northern Gaza. And even the State Department has said that the famine is likely taking place. And when you talk about a famine, it's important to mention that to have a famine, 2 per 100,000 people have to be dying every day. And so think about kind of like a recession or something like that. If you declared famine, you're already in it, right? Already 20 or 60 people in northern Gaza, because I think there's about 300,000 people there, would be dying a day from deprivation. So these are mainly going to be children. So this is very intentional. And also, if you look at other statements from the Israeli government, from the top at Netanyahu talking about, you know, go into Gaza and remember Amalek. And of course, the biblical story behind that is God ordering the Israelites to slaughter the people of Amalek, including the children and even the livestock. And you have, you know, on down from Netanyahu, completely down through the Israeli government, essentially every minister who's not maybe a member of one of the left-wing parties or the Arab party have openly said that they want the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. And some have even talked about turning it into a parking lot using nuclear weapons. So the Israelis have been pretty explicit about what they intend to do there. And they even held a big conference, 15 of the 120 members of the Israeli Knesset attended, where they were explicitly planning settlements in Gaza for when the Palestinians are gone.
Pretty horrifying. And so just to, I guess, put a button on this particular part of the conversation, I guess a lot of the death numbers come from the Gaza Health Ministry that people argue is tied in with Hamas. I've seen instances. The one that speaks to mind was there was a crazy attack that the Israelis did. It wasn't in Gaza, but it was in a hospital, and they killed, I think, actual terrorist members, and it wasn't reported by the health minister. I don't remember the specifics on this, but I guess the question I'm asking is, if you had to, and obviously not everyone's been found in rubble or otherwise, but if you had to give your best guess, how many like pure civilians do you think have been killed by Israel since this started?
I would say the number's probably over 50,000, and I could kind of give my rationale behind that. The official number put out by the Gaza Health Ministry is now just under 33,000. And these are names collected. So if somebody goes to a morgue, a UN shelter, something like that, the body goes there, then it's going to be counted. There's still a lot of bodies under the rubble. There's 5,000 people missing. But of those 33,000, 70% are women and children, right? So definitely for sure, innocent civilians are 70%. The other 30% are men. And again, if you look at, you know, 30,000 men in Gaza prior to this were members of Hamas. And so that means, you know, maybe 1%, less than 1% were members of Hamas. And so I don't see any reason why we shouldn't assume that at least a large number of the remaining 30% are still, you know, innocent civilians. A lot of people, you know, they're just under the rubble. They haven't been found. They're probably never going to be found. And so we're really not going to know the official number probably ever. It'll be an estimate. I just think is the 50,000 is likely, especially when you look at, and I would count like the starvation figures and stuff like that, and that where we do know that at least tens of people are starving to death in northern Gaza already. And that number is likely to be much higher when we find out what it really is.
And is there any record in the past of the Gaza Health Ministry overstating these things, or I guess from a historical perspective, when they're giving numbers on these, like on these type of issues, they're accurate?
Yeah, that's been the case. The last major Israeli bombing campaign in Gaza was Operation Cast Lead in 2008. And there have been a lot since that, but that was, you know, the largest one the past two decades. And at that time, the Gaza Health Ministry numbers almost lined up exactly with the Israeli toll. There's an article I could send you. It's published in the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft by Matthew Petty. And he goes through it and explains how historically the Gaza Health Ministry numbers have been fairly accurate, and why they are accurate. And a part of that is the population of Gaza has been through so many rounds of bombing campaign. They kind of understand that to have their relative count it, you have to get them to one of these facilities. And so they're very good about knowing how to handle dead bodies and bringing them to certain morgues or something like that before just burying people. So the Gaza Health Ministry numbers have proven to be accurate in the past. This time they're, you know, a significant undercount because Israel has attacked and destroyed most of the facilities where people would bring bodies. And so many people have just been killed either by Israeli forces or buried under the rubble and just not counted at all.
Okay. Now, for this next little piece, I don't know that I have the most cohesive opinion here, but, you know, I look back on, I know people that survived the Holocaust, and never in my entire life have I ever thought I have to go to Germany and kill Germans. It's not a thought in my head. Never had that thought. I don't really, like, I mean, it happened, and it's tragic, but I live here, which could be the big difference. I don't live next to any of these people, and then also they're not a threat to my life in any way. I'm able to live a good life. And so I just move forward with living a good life. There's no thought of, hey, I have to conduct revenge on Germans. And with that, I kind of think people, they just are actually more interested in their economic and financial interests. And if people can live a good life and they've got an opportunity to live a good life, I think they will. I think Israel's kind of got this, and this is where my opinion probably diverges from you. I look at the whole, I don't know the history of how both these people ended up there. I don't know, understand all the occupying. I'm a little bit more pragmatic of like, you guys are both here. You got to figure that one out. Like Israel not leaving. I don't think Gaza's leaving. And I don't think trying to bomb Gaza into submission is anything other than cruel. I think this idea that you're going to force them to submit under your will and just live in, you know, a destitute lifestyle where they're locked off isn't like, I don't think Gaza is finally going to come back and go, yeah, I don't know. You can put a tracker on me everywhere I go. And yes, I will submit and live a life where, you know, it's entirely under Israel's rule. I don't think I don't think that's going to work. And I think Israel almost looks at this like, these people are going to be so violent towards us. We have no choice. But that brings me to kind of the narrative, which I don't know how true it is, that Netanyahu strategically has empowered Hamas so that he would never really have to contend with peace with Gaza, which makes sense. If you really never want to have to deal with these people, and I guess you hope to like really just hope that they die and go away in some sort of an odd strategy of locking them up, keeping them in that area, or however you want to describe it. But it's almost this wishful thinking of, we're going to be as mean as we possibly can, and hopefully they die off or something. I don't really know what the long-term strategy is other than for them to go, how do we never contend with the fact that they're there and that they're human beings? And so this plays into something that I haven't really researched, but this storyline that Netanyahu basically actively pursued having Hamas in the area so that he could go, hey, you guys are supporting terrorists. So yeah, obviously you can't ever be your own state, or you can't have, basic freedoms. And I've heard that there's been reportings of that from Israeli publications. And there was a story in the New York Times that once the war started, Qatar asked about continuing payments to, I guess, Hamas directly. And Israel approved of those payments, saying, I don't even understand the logic there as to why you would deprive food and water to the area, but money, the most fungible of items, you would say they can have that. So I turn it back to you. If I guess you could point to if that's true, and if you had like more of the, I guess, direct evidence of Netanyahu's involvement in, you know, empowering Hamas so that he wouldn't have to contend with Gaza for peace.
Yeah, I'll start with the empowering Hamas part. And for anybody, you know, this is a big claim, obviously. So for anybody who wants to really spend the time and look at the history, there's a great article. I can send you a link for it, Robbie. It's published at antiwar.com. It's in Scott Horton's. It's probably his first or second most recent article at antiwar.com in his author bio. And it's titled, "We Control the Height of the Flame." And that's a quote from an Israeli official, a former defense minister who served under Netanyahu, who was talking about the role that Hamas played for the Israeli government. And so For a long time, the West and every country that supports Israel has done so, saying that we support Israel so one day it will lead to a two-state solution. The problem with this for Israel is they don't want a two-state solution. They want a one-state solution where it's just Israel that controls everything. And so you, in that article, there's probably 15 to 20 quotes from Israeli officials, mainly from Netanyahu's own Likud party, that explain that Hamas being in charge of Gaza means that there's a split between Hamas and Fatah, which is the Palestinian Authority, which controls the West Bank. And if there was the same political entity for both, and it was the Palestinian Authority, then this is kind of an official government entity that works with the Israeli government. And so there would be a significant amount of pressure on the Israelis to negotiate a two-state solution with the Palestinians. But Hamas is this terrorist organization who fights back against the Israelis and, you know, kills Israeli citizens and does, you know, some really horrific things as well. And so that gives Israel a pretext to not negotiate with the Palestinians, because Robbie, how could you possibly negotiate for a Palestinian state when one half of that Palestinian state is run by a terrorist organization? So that's the mentality of the Israeli government. And that's a policy that they maintain for the past two decades or so, since the 2007 elections in Gaza. And during that time, Israel, and you know, this is well documented, even in Israeli media, where Qatar would have been willing to halt payments to Hamas. And, you know, this could have led to some kind of revolution or overthrow of Hamas, but Israel chose to keep funding Hamas to keep them in charge of Gaza, with, you know, the ultimate thing of wanting Hamas in charge of Gaza for this reason. And that's why since October 7th, when the Biden administration, who's Israel's main benefactor, where the Biden administration is working to send Israel an additional $14 billion in weapons this year, they've been saying that we want the Palestinian Authority in charge of Gaza after this war ends. And the Israeli government has said, absolutely not. We will not allow that. And so it's not about, you know, not wanting terrorists in charge of Gaza. It's about maintaining that split so that they never have to negotiate a Palestinian state. And what was the second part of your question there, Robbie?
I don't know. I think you answered it.
Since October 7th? So yeah. I saw that you mentioned this in the outline that you sent me, and I really looked to try to see what was going on with payments to Hamas since October 7th. And other than that New York Times article that you referenced, I haven't found anything else either to suggest that that policy has changed. My assumption is that they're not sending any money to the armed wing of Hamas, the Al-Qassam Brigade, but rather to some officials in Gaza that run some offices like the health ministry office, the education department, maybe some humanitarian assistance programs and things like that. And then there's also a matter of the funding for UNRWA, which is the UN agency for Gaza that provides aid there. And even with that, even though Israel says that they're a member of Hamas, they have said that UNRWA in some way is actually helpful at this point to the Israeli military, because if a full-on like plague breaks out in Gaza, that could create some problems for the Israeli military operating in the area. There's already outbreaks of diphtheria and hepatitis A, which are pretty serious illnesses. And there's Israeli scholars that are warning that this could spread to the Israeli soldiers if they get too close to the Palestinian civilians and that plague gets too bad.
Some crazy shit. All right. I think that covers all of my questions. Before I let you go, firstly, if you want to tell people where they can follow your work, and if there's anything else, if you have any closing remarks of things you think we didn't cover that you think people should be aware of.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything. I mean, I could sit here and talk to you for 2 days, Robbie, about all of this and really try to get into all the details and about how horrible it is. But if you want to know more, I host a podcast, Conflicts of Interest, 3 days a week. I'm the opinion editor at antiwar.com. So I put together the viewpoints there, and I'm the news editor at the Libertarian Institute. So I write news stories every day. A lot of those end up at antiwar.com as well. So if you want to learn more, check that out and follow me. If anybody has any questions, I'm on Twitter @KyleAnslone_. I'm now just short of 5,000 Twitter followers.
There you go.
Be great if you follow me and I could break that 5,000 cap. But also, if you have any questions about why I said, I'm always willing to provide links, or, you know, as long as nobody calls me an anti-Semite, I'm usually pretty willing to engage with anyone.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Give us the information, and hope to see you out on Porch Tour one of these dates. I know I saw you in St. Louis last, but I don't even know where you live. Are you down in Texas?
No, I'm out in Boston area, actually. Oh, so cool. East Coast. My family's from St. Louis, so I know I caught you out there, and I was living in Colorado for a while, so I saw you do a couple dates out there. So looking forward to see you back in that, my area.
There you go. I'm trying to, you got a porch up in Boston? I'd like to play Boston.
You know, I do got a house for it. We probably need to get a little bit more work done, but we'll have to talk about it in the future.
All right. I'm trying to get a Boston gig going. Haven't played Boston in a while. All right. I'm going to let you go. And I think I got a couple slides left. Thank you, Mr. Kyle. All right. I think this has been a long episode. Let's just take a quick look at what the other topics I had was. This is going to be the Call and Leftover show in the very near future, everybody. I hope everyone's excited for once we get my friend Andrew finishes the back end and we're able to start doing the Call-In Leftover show for all the things that get left at the end of episodes. Yeah, we're not. It's too late in the episode. What, are we going to talk about abortion after all that Israel talk? No, we're skipping that. Hillary Clinton was on Jimmy Fallon. My guess is we'll probably talk about that on Part of the Problem. The best part about that was her talking about you could vote for an old guy who gets things done or the old guy who's in 40 million criminal court cases, which is what I was saying they were going to say. They create their own news. They tie the guy up in all the court cases and then go, look at how much of a criminal he is. He's got all these court cases going on. And then there were, oh, this is a fun one. 38% of voters don't think Biden will make it. All right, that's our show. Thank you for hanging out with us. Hit me up, robsnewsroom@gmail.com. We've got Porch Tour is coming together next weekend. I will be out in Portland with Dave Smith. I'm looking forward to that. We're playing a nice theater out there. So come hang out and let's take a couple comments. A couple comments. We'll call it an episode. We've got Amanda Huggenkiss letting me know that they like the guest. Wait, why is this not? Hold on a second. Let's get rid of this. Great show. Thank you. You're welcome. Thanks, Kyle. I agree. Some quack. Well, one of you will talk about it on POTP anyways. That's a good one. You know, some good zingers in the comment section. Ashtray, go on Tower Gang. I would gladly go back on Tower Gang. Maybe we'll wait till I got all the Porch Tour dates lined up and I'll go plug it. Sterling W, they set the bar at Have You Heard of Hamas? All right, that is our episode. Back, I don't think Monday, probably next week, Wednesday and Friday for new episodes, or maybe just Wednesday. I hope to see you there. And until next time, get out there and run your mouth.